Yeah, this introduction was hard to write, but so writers are supposed to tell the difficult truths. Peter's done that abundantly. So let me try my hand at it. Let's stroll down memory lane to 1980s Gloucester, when many of the columns in Peter's new collection were written. I think it's important to better see the courage and the function of Peter's newspaper writing from that time. I was there too. That was the time of my childhood, and I grew up in the same downtown neighborhood as Peter, Centennial Avenue, Granite Street, Riggs, Lower Middle on the Boulevard. So, 1980. Proposition 2.5 was voted in. Jimmy Carter was voted out. The Gloucester School Committee closed the neighborhood schools, including the Hovey School, which had anchored our neighborhood. Red tide was poisoning New England shellfish, and the Seabrook reactor was in the midst of construction. My Gloucester childhood coincided with the city having bottomed out in unemployment, drug addiction, constant crime, and meaningless violence. Housebreaks and thefts were routine. Stolen cars were found burnt out and dumped in strange locations. Pharmacies were robbed for their drugs at gunpoint. I was instructed by my teachers in elementary school not to touch used heroin needles if we found them on the playground. Needless to say, I'm apprehensive around playgrounds. My earliest memory consists of my mother and her friend in our kitchen around Halloween discussing what they would do if a masked man who'd been breaking into neighborhood houses to assault women managed to force his way in. Needless to say, I don't do Halloween. I still double and triple check my locks, my car doors, where my wallet is. I'm quick to defend myself when I feel I'm being attacked or threatened. Once, when I was stabbed in sixth grade, the kid who stabbed me told me he had used a dirty heroin needle to do the job, and that in stabbing me, he had given me AIDS, and that I would die soon. I remember that bus ride home thinking, you know what? Considering what I've got to contend with, death doesn't seem that bad. Sometimes I visit this other Gloucester on the Sawyer Free Library's microfilm rolls, studying the daily tallies of crime and scandal from the 1980s. Seeing that, actually, it had been worse than I had suspected. In retrospect, I was sheltered by strict parents who were also supportive and encouraging and saw me through to college. As I run through the microfilm, there on the editorial page of the Gloucester Times, in the midst of so much failure, waste, and human viciousness, are the columns of Peter Anastas. Contemplative, elegiac, pastoral. His columns had titles like Endless Winters of Childhood, or Memories of Christmas Past, or Sounds of Summer. And I'm thinking to myself, what the hell is this? What's Peter doing? In the midst of all this, Peter's writing about fond childhood memories. How do I reconcile this with Peter's total dedication to the city's most vulnerable at Action, Inc.? So I had to meditate on this and ponder why Peter would have chosen to write what he had at the time he had. And then it struck me. Peter was describing not only his own childhood, but what childhood should be, what it can be, to a city in which so many kids were being neglected and abused. Not only did he evoke a lost Gloucester, but he was carefully laying out what a functioning city looks like for a city that had unraveled. Peter was a brave counterpoint. He conjured images of decency. He presented behavioral models, ideals. He told us it didn't have to be this way. We're capable of so much more. Look who we used to be. We can be that again. Peter Anastas was a light in the darkness, and despite the reversals, setbacks, disappointments, I know Peter has not just yet given up hope. Peter.
Thank you so much, Dave. That's very beautiful. Gloucester's a place where you are still characterized by your ethnic heritage. I grew up Greek here. Oh, sure, we always knew we were Americans, but nevertheless, we were called Greeks. Those Greeks down the cut, as distinct from the Greeks along Main Street or at the bottom of Portugee Hill. And we, my grandparents, three aunts and uncles, their own families and ourselves, all lived in a little compound between Perkins Road and Lower Centennial Avenue. An aunt lived there until recently. The Italians, properly Sicilians, we went to the Hovey School with, lived down the fort and in Washington Square and Gould Court. And the Portuguese kids we made friends with at Central Grammar lived mostly on the hill. We could understand each other's grandmothers, which meant that each of us had a working vocabulary in at least Italian, beyond stugats and managgia, and Portuguese. And we came to recognize the smells of each other's houses. We knew when it was the day to cook coivish, the Azorean kale soup, or squid in spinach and tomato sauce, ragu with sausages and green peppers, Italian anise cookies. The tang of cloves and honey announced my grandmother's baklava, and the smell of singed onions, oregano, and fresh mint let us know she was cooking those little Greek meatballs called keftedes. My brother and I would knock on my grandmother's front door on the day of the week Yaya always made keftedes, and she'd greet us with one in each hand. Then we'd turn around and sneak in her back door. No one ever locked their doors in those days, not even at night, and pilfer a few more off the stove. One night, we heard her telling my mother, "I could swear I made more keftedes." And the time, it was with Billy Holman's Russell Baxter Henderson. We swiped the cooling apple pie off Mrs. Anderson's windowsill, escaping to Rider's Rocks to devour it. Crazy days, those in 1940s Gloucester after the war. The prosperity was coming back along with our cousins and uncles who gave us their battle helmets and war medals. That was before urban renewal destroyed Rogers Street and the waterfront. And every Sunday morning, my grandfather, Angel Paulison, took my brother and me down to the fort to watch the men unload the fishing boats. On the way back, we always stopped at Lufkin's Diner when it was down by Tally's for chocolate donuts and coffee half and half. My dad owned the corner store on the boulevard in Centennial. What Greek didn't own a store or a luncheonette? Many's the day I wish I'd kept the family business. I'd be my own boss now, which, of course, was the dream of so many Greeks, not to mention Italian and Portuguese families with their own boats or supply businesses, the Lebanese with their grocery and variety stores off Maplewood Avenue and Cleveland Street. That was the good of it. The nice things from our separate cultures, the way we all shared our food, got tipsy on our grandfather's home vintage wine, joked about how our uncles would be snoring in their easy chairs after Sunday dinner, and how, if you didn't understand Italian or Greek, you'd think they were fighting next door, when all they were doing was having a big family dinner. It got nasty sometimes. When a kid really wanted to stick it to you, it was, "You greasy Greek, your father don't even speak English right." And so Dad, who was such an impeccable gentleman, as I'm not, didn't. But he certainly put Eddie Bloomberg in his place when he wisecracked once about how, like his own father, Dad murdered the English language. "I'd like to see what you would do," my father answered. "Just off the boat, like your father, in me, in a new country, no one to turn to, and not a word of English." There had been struggles, only barely perceived by our second generation in Gloucester. But we had a sense of what it must have been like for the Jews and the Greeks, who came in after the Irish and the Italians. How somehow it seemed that we, like our mothers, just had to get better grades in school. My brother and I never won the Sawyer Medal, breaking a family tradition and my grandfather's heart. But maybe we had to crack the mold. Who ever heard of a Greek-American writer in those days, let alone a jazz player who wasn't black? All of the waterfront, the cut, downtown Gloucester, the Boulevard, Stagefort Park, and Pavilion Beach was our stomping ground. Lanesville and Folly Cove might have been Mongolia, for all we knew. We were far removed from those places, and Rockport, until the gas ration was lifted, and we could take Sunday afternoon drives around the Cape. That is, if we had automobiles. And not everyone on Perkins Road did. We were working class, or lower middle, and we knew it, even though we didn't know the terms. I remember the first time I ever set foot on Eastern Point. All those incredibly blonde, incredibly tanned people, in rumpled, expensive clothes, stockingless feet in loafers or tennis shoes, at the yacht club. The distant nasal way they spoke English to our broad Gloucester. Kids in boarding school reading The Wasteland, while our public school teachers only assigned us The Courtship of Miles Standish. The effortless way they swung golf club or tennis racket, the way they seemed to take naturally to any sport, playing touch football so cavalierly, and with such verbal irony, like the Kennedys later in Washington. While we bumped and banged at Newell Stadium on Saturday mornings, Perkins Road against the Fort, the Golden Guineas, the game often ending in shout-out or fight, kids sent home in their underpants. Even after all these years, I'm still uptight when I walk through Annisquam. Somehow I feel I don't belong there, even though I left the cut behind 30 years and a couple of college degrees ago. This was written in 78, so it's more than 30 years. And lived in Europe. Your class stays with you in Gloucester. And I suspect it's just as determining a factor in your life here as your ethnic background. You grew up knowing your place, where you were welcome and around town and where you weren't, even though you'd probably never be kicked out. People were too polite, and it was more cutting to be treated with that superiority if you were sensitive to it than to be blatantly ordered off Cambridge Beach, Brace Cove, or the Bass Rocks Golf Club. Maybe much of this has changed with Gloucester's entry into the 20th century in recent years. Though my ex-wife always said you could raise kids here without knowing that Sigmund Freud had ever lived. In a more positive vein, some things haven't. My brother would come back from months on the road with Woody Herman and marvel at the men still hanging out on Sterling's Corner or across the street at the bank, joking about how we'd both be out there ourselves someday. "It won't be far off, man. Just think, we'll have earned a place of honor in Gloucester. And we never made the Rotary Club." There's more, so much more. Gloucester is a rich and often explosive social mix. You'd need a book, a big one, to explore and document it. Someday I want to try. But for now, that's the real Gloucester, or part of it, for me. This column was written for Peter Watson, who was the very great, late and very great editor of the Gloucester Times. Peter asked four of us. He asked me, Joe Garland, Kim Bartlett, and Herb Kenny, who was a former Boston Post reporter and editor and Boston Globe arts editor. He asked us each to write a piece during the summer of, August of 1978, about what we thought was the real Gloucester. So each of us wrote a piece, and this was the piece that I wrote. And as a result of that, Peter asked me if I would be willing to contribute a weekly column to the Gloucester Times. I agreed to do it. It was a tough time for me. I've been divorced. I was working full-time at Action, teaching two nights a week at North Shore Community College, driving into Cambridge every Tuesday night to see my kids and make dinner for them while their mother went to school, and every other Friday night after work, driving to Cambridge to pick them up and bring them back to Gloucester so they could spend the weekend with me. As you can imagine, I got no writing done. So when Peter asked me to do this, I hesitated. I thought, where am I going to get the time to do it? Peter said, you'll find the time, because the pressure of having to produce a column once a week will do the trick. So that began the journey, which lasted for 12 years, and I wrote 620 columns.
Wow.
And here's another kind. The book is divided into four sections. One, the first section is called This Side of the Cut, which was the name of the column, to denote that I was writing about Gloucester things on the island. The second section is called A Walker in the City, which is not only about walks through Gloucester, it also bears the name of a column I wrote 10 years after I had stopped writing a column for the Gloucester Times in a wonderful little alternative paper called North Shore North. And the ink drawing on the cover of the book by Jim Oliver, a fantastic local artist, was drawn to go with that column in the year 2000. The third section of the book is called Seasons and Days, in which I write about living through the seasons on Cape Ann. And the fourth section is called Facing the Issues, which are columns, the kinds of columns that Dave Rich described that I wrote about social and political issues in Gloucester. Here's a column from The Walker in the City. This morning in the old stacks of the Sawyer Free Library, I'm looking back to my high school days. I see so many of the same books I read 35 or more years ago. Smell their bindings, the old paper and the glue, an often rebound copy of Dostoevsky's The Idiot, and a far greater preserved volume of Dreiser's An American Tragedy, which you could not sign out unless you had a note from home or your teacher. That's why it was in such good condition. Living in Gloucester, walking these precious streets, Dale Avenue, Middle Street, I touch hands with my entire history. My walks to and from Sunday school at the old Trinity Congregational Church, trips to the library on Saturday mornings, Sears and Roebuck for a coping saw I had saved up for, to the Strand or North Shore theaters for Saturday matinees, how well I remember walking each day to the Hovey and Central Grammar Schools in spring and fall mornings on winter days, and the walks home after lingering in the Central Grammar Library to talk with Martha Patton, on whom I had a terrible crush. Oh, those agonizing feelings, being in love with a girl and not knowing how to tell her or what to do. I would end up just hanging around. school where she was likely to be, maybe at a play rehearsal. Then I'd walk home at dusk along the quiet streets, the smell of dinner cooking in the lighted houses, dreaming, brooding in the dying light. How well I knew that earlier Gloucester. I knew each house I walked past from Central Grammar all the way down Middle Street to the Boulevard, or down Mansfield Street after accompanying my friend Bob Stevenson home. Then I'd take a shortcut through lower Mansfield Street out past Nick's grocery store and Babson Court to my house on Perkins Road. Tourists came from all over the world to see the man at the wheel, but we passed it each day, hardly ever noticing it. Those houses and streets, the way the light looks in early spring or late fall, and leaves blown down the boulevard by the wind off the water. The people I used to know, so many of them dead now, are all part of my body, integrated into my cells, my bloodstream. Images, pictures of this or that encounter come to the surface if I take those walks again. In the Gloucester that was all I ever knew of the world outside of maybe Beckett, Massachusetts, where I went to summer camp, or Boston on Saturday shopping excursions with my mother, the circus of the ice follies, trips on the train to Salem during and after the war, a week in Hyannis while my Uncle Henry Lassley was stationed at Camp Edwards with the National Guard. That's all I ever saw, except maybe for that magical trip to New York with my parents when my brother and I were still in Hovey School, when we stayed at the St. Moritz Hotel and saw Rockefeller Plaza in winter and the Bronx Zoo when we were part of the live audience one night while Perry Como sang at the Chesterfield Supper Club on the radio. Gloucester was my universe, dense and thick, sweet with the tactility of everyday life, the sounds of Sicilian being spoken on the waterfront where my grandfather took us each Sunday morning to watch the fish coming off the boats, the smells of the harbor and the beaches, kerosene delivered to the cellar, ice carried into the house on people's backs, horse-drawn wagons full of fruits and vegetables. I can close my eyes and it all comes back in such profusion, such diversity that I can hardly contain it. Can't fix or hold the images. Main Street aswarm with shoppers on Saturday mornings. The stores all closed on Wednesday afternoons. The piles of candies at Kresge's, root beer in big mugs at the lunch counter. And the magic hour, as Charles Olson called it. Main Street after 5 p.m. The stores closing. The buses full of workers or shoppers going home for supper, leaving the waiting station. Just a few kids lingering on the street in front of the pool parlor. And the light, all golden on the red bricks of Middle and Pleasant Streets, then falling to gunmetal blue behind Trinity's spire, white houses stained purple with it, dusk encroaching. I'd walk home up center and through middle just to see or feel it around me, the intimacy of day coming to a close, the sense of belonging, it to me, I to it. Too quickly at times it all washes over me, the concatenation of memories, of images just lying in wait behind houses whose colors have changed now, whose porches have disintegrated, yet it was real. Each minute of every day now lost, so many of the people I knew dead now, their houses gone, even the dogs and cats we once knew. The endless days we wanted to pass so quickly in our youth, not realizing that we could never have them again, never hold them except in memory in that vast structure of recollection that explodes like a fissioned atom at the prodding of a single thought, plunging us back into a time and place no less palpable than the streets we walk on now with older bodies and an ache for what was and no longer can be. So I see a boy in eighth grade, his hair slicked down with wild root lotion, walking home from school in a maroon and silver baseball jacket, feeling already the things I feel now, seeing what I can only recall by an effort of memory, little knowing that years later he would walk those same streets, remembering himself as he was then in a Gloucester he still lives in now. I can read one more if you'd like it. And we really would love to have Emil jump in and take over. This one is called We Must Listen to the Dreamers. This is the last column I wrote for the Gloucester Times. At the end of one cataclysmic century and the beginning of a new era, the single great condition of our lives is loss. Those of us who have lived for at least a generation have experienced unprecedented loss due mainly to change, technological change, political and social change, change in the very landscape of our lives. Looking back over what I have written in these columns, I am struck by the persistence of the theme of loss. Loss in my own life of people, places, and things. Loss in the world around me of a meaningful or coherent pattern of life. I have tried to describe this loss, feeling that if I experienced it, others must also. And if I tried to articulate my own sense of loss in the face of change, others might respond with a sense of theirs. There is an atmosphere of nostalgia that pervades a good deal of my writing, as it does my life itself. It is a nostalgia for what I once saw or knew, for people who are now dead, for the terrain of my childhood on Cape Ann, some of which has miraculously survived the change that has come more slowly here than it has in other communities. I have tried to make mine a functional nostalgia rather than a regressive one, comparing my memory of what was to what exists today in order to demonstrate the extent of our loss. Over the years, I have come to feel that being born in Gloucester and having lived here for the greater part of my life has been a rare privilege. I have realized that one of my responsibilities as a writer and a member of the community is to try to bring into focus everything I have learned here and elsewhere to keep Cape Ann from going the way of the rest of the country, losing not only its character, which we all cherish, but its sense of itself as a unique human and ecological community. I have tried to describe my growing sense that we are where we live, and if we allow those places to be destroyed, along with the values and folkways associated with them, we are in effect destroying ourselves. I have also tried to articulate my own sense of loss of an original Gloucester, the Gloucester of my childhood and formative years. Gloucester as a small town with a single main street and ethnically rich neighborhoods stretching out to embrace the Cape. Realizing that there are layers of human experience which only people who have become intimate with a place can understand, I have tried to remind my readers of those experiences as I recall them. I have tried to underscore the value of such shared experience in helping us to anchor ourselves in a rich present while we plan carefully for a viable future. I have tried especially to point out that what we have enjoyed in Gloucester in the way of indigenous life is not worth losing to those who, like the developers of malls, packaged housing, or consumed lifestyles, would make this place like any other in the nation. I have stressed these thoughts not because I believe that everything here is adequate and should not be changed, but because I have come to understand that those who have taken away from us have not given us much of equal value in return. Indeed, our resistance to change has been the only way we could take a stand on the importance of predictability in our lives. For no one can live in a healthy relationship to others or the natural world if all we experience around us is the erosion of the familiar. Take that away and you end up with anxiety and anger because, as with any loss, whether it is of a person, a beloved place, or an object, one's structure of meaning is shaken. The way we understand ourselves and our world is undermined, and we find ourselves in a perpetual condition of bereavement. Developers and planners, in fact, most decision makers, hardly ever consider the human consequences of change. Only recently have studies shown that the policy of urban renewal, widely undertaken in the 1950s and 60s, was mistaken because it undermined a basic sense of community. It displaced residents and tore down familiar neighborhoods. An equal loss of landscape in rural areas today has left those residents bereft. not only of a traditional land base, but a way of life associated with it. The same would happen in Gloucester if we lost our fishing industry. What is needed, along with careful planning to account for change, is a land ethic, a way in which we view the land and its uses beyond mere profit-taking and commercial development. Yes, we must build what we need, but we must do it in a way that does not destroy the unique character of places or disrupt human and natural ecologies. We must plan regionally as well as locally, always with a sense of preserving the character and integrity of particular communities. For I believe that only those places which are sensitive to their uniqueness will survive. Ultimately, it will be the dreamers, not the schemers, we must listen to. For without an informed, coherent, and humane vision of ourselves in relation to our environment, we will not survive as a community, let alone as a planet or a species. Thank you. Thank you. I thank you. Amiel Alkalis, Gloucester roots run deep. He grew up in the Rambler cottage at 50 Rocky Neck Avenue with his parents, Albert and Vera, and his brother Leo, during the summer months of the 1950s. His artist father, Albert, whose paintings will be the centerpiece of Four Winds, an upcoming exhibition of East Gloucester art in the 1950s at the Cape Ann Museum, opens the 15th of June. You've got to see it. His father taught art classes on the Neck and showed his paintings in the Cape Ann Festival of the Arts into the 1960s. Amiel played badminton with the poet Charles Olson, a close family friend. And when he was a teenager, he began visiting Vincent Farini, another family friend, at the Frame Shop across the street, which is now the Gloucester Writers' Center, and exchanging poetry and letters, resulting in Vincent graduating Amiel summa cum laude from the Farini School of Poetry and Life. Currently, Amiel is...
That's the degree I got.
What an education. Currently, Amiel is deputy chair of the PhD program in English at the CUNY Graduate Center and former chair of Classical, Middle Eastern, and Asian Languages and Cultures at Queen's College. He is the founder and general editor under the auspices of the PhD program in English and the Center for the Humanities at CUNY Graduate Center of Lost and Found, the CUNY Poetics Document Initiative, co-publisher of my book, A Walker in the City. Among many books, Amiel's the author of After Jews and Arabs, a landmark study toward an understanding of Levantine culture, Memories of Our Future, a collection of essays about diasporas, dislocations, and genocidal exterminations provoked by nationalism and the various forms of fanaticism that impact our lives today. From the Warring Factions, a book-length poem dedicated to the Bosnian town of Srebrenica, site of the massacre of some 7,000 Muslim men and boys in 1995. A novel, Islanders, set during the last years of the war in Vietnam and moving between hardscrabble Atlantic coastal fishing towns and northeastern cities in upheaval, while exploring how one comes to self-understanding through the places one inhabits, both in memory and actuality. And his latest, which you'll be talking about tonight, along with the other books, A Little History, an examination of the impact of the Cold War on American politics, education, art, literature, and consciousness through the lens of Charles Olson's poetry and thought. Amiel's life and his work as a poet, novelist, translator, critic, scholar, and journalist have taken him to Israel and Palestine, to the former Yugoslavia, which was home to his parents before the Second World War, back and forth across America. And yet Gloucester has continued as a touchstone for his work, through his understanding of Olson and Farini's insistence that we must sustain a viable sense of community in the face of the worldwide neoliberal assault on the local and the particular, on indigenous life. And Olson's teaching that one's life, be dedicated to finding out for oneself. As Olson said, looking for oneself for the evidence of what is said, instead of falling prey to the spectacle. It is a pleasure to welcome Amiel home again. Thank you.
It's very overwhelming. And what a pleasure to be here. Very hard act to follow, too, because I was so emotional and delivered with such beauty. I was going to talk through some things, but I think I'll do some of that and read. I'm going to read differently than I had originally thought because of what Peter read. One of the things that strikes me about, you know, the good fortune of being able to help co-publish Peter's book, which are newspaper columns, is to just think about that, newspaper columns, the idea of having an opinion piece in a newspaper. Okay, one of my first jobs was a paper route. Then as a teenager, I bundled the Boston Phoenix all night in Boston. Then later on in New York, I did copy boy work at the New York Post. Then I did journalist work in various places abroad here. I came to realize when I was putting together this second edition of From the Warring Factions that I lived through the end of newspaper print culture, and I didn't quite understand what was happening as it was happening. It took me some time to figure it out. And what happened in my case was I've been writing a lot in the 80s and 90s for places like The Nation, The Village Voice, occasional pieces. I had a piece, various kinds of things. And at a certain point towards, I finished this book in August 2001, okay, just some weeks before 9/11. And I gave an interview with a Bosnian paper called, just about a week before 9/11, and the title of the interview was After the Fall of Communism, the West Finds Its Enemy in Islam. And places that I had been publishing kind of, they didn't really disinvite me, but they didn't invite me. I had nowhere to publish anything in this country. And the people that I had been writing for abroad said, please, you know, write for us. So I started writing for Al-Ahram Weekly in Cairo, in Egypt, English Weekly. I had a column in the Bosnian Weekly that was called Politics and Imagination. The first column went out the evening of 9/11 because they got in touch with me. They said, can you do something? And oddly, you know, there was still print culture operative, and it was very liberating. At first, it was strange to be, you know, uninvited, but then I soon found it was very liberating to have a place where I could write, and I wasn't concerned with the kind of editing that takes place here. So the kind of imagery I was using, the kind of basic things I was able to say were very different than they would have been had I been writing in the U.S. Anyways, I just wanted to say that because I'm going to begin with a poem that begins a little history, and the first section of the book is called If All the World Were Paper. And this poem is for Jess Collins in memoriam. Jess Collins, great artist and life partner of the poet Robert Duncan. One, life opens out of a dream of the end. I thought I wrote about, but only spoke of, that night in the snow of Baghdad, the poem in Arabic, the huge crowd now part of the great unraveling, the generations turning, almost everyone gone, the mantle there to to be taken up like a gauntlet, the dead everywhere. I can hardly remember them. Truth is marching in, illuminated. Even a glimpse into your life as it got darker and the fabric ripped, the idea to find a republic, underground, undone now by a watermelon patch, by a thatched hut, a horse and buggy, a door in time. 2. Sick in bed turning, I have seen green globes of water, a field of pumpkins grown for seed, a castle spun from yarn, the place of the lion. You turn off the light and turn on the dark. You turn off the dark and turn on the light. On the way to Rose Mountain, the truth shall be thy warrant. Young people in particular will find it. When will we, crossing and recrossing the heart, tempt the frailty of our powers, torture the eagle till she weep? And I want to read a quote from a poet who I knew as a teenager and loved dearly, John Wieners, who lived in Gloucester for a while. And John has a quote here which continues to strike me again and again. It'll strike me if I can find it. It's here. But where? Jesus, ridiculous. I thought I was being smart by putting bigger stickies up, and I blew it. Just give me a second. It's worth the wait. It's a very short quote, but it's very important. Yes, here. John Wieners, 1972. I'll read this twice. Just since 1955, poetry, or verse, as some would prefer it be called, has, despite all forebodings that it was dying, taken through a handful of writers in the United States a stranglehold on established modes of thought, analysis, and attention. Since 1955, poetry, or verse, as some would prefer it be called, has, despite all forebodings that it was dying, taken through a handful of writers in the United States a stranglehold on established modes of thought, analysis, and attention. Okay, so what John Wieners is saying, basically, and the premise of this whole very complicated book, which is hard to read from because the arguments are long, is that a group of particular writers during the Cold War, when thought became colonized and knowledges became territorialized into very particular vocabularies, a handful of poets figured it out. They figured out that knowledge and experience can be known wholly and fully. And that is what this book is an investigation of and about, and particularly through the work of Charles Olson. And one of Olson's very basic premises, which is extraordinary, and I still find it, I've been working a lot in archives and with people who are dealing with information and abundances of information. And Olson already figured out in the late 40s and early 50s that the biggest problem that one had to face was, as he said, where do you cut the knot and make fact fable again? Where do you cut the knot? You're overwhelmed with this abundance of information. And how do you what critical thought allows you to make the decision that this information is useful and worthwhile? And I think it's something we're all grappling with. We're all grappling with because we are overwhelmed by information. And so this book is really an attempt to try to come to some terms with that, both historical, political, personal information, and how one organizes it. So I'm going to read a couple of sections of the book. If you wore an army jacket in 1969, 1970, or 1971, it either meant you were a veteran or that you identified with the soldiers and veterans fighting the war against the war in Vietnam. That was still the case when I took classes at City College in New York in the mid-1970s. The draft had passed me by, but a number of the students studying ancient Greek with me were older and survivors of the war in Vietnam. They were eager to find and lose themselves in texts as archaic and startling as their experiences must have been. Olson would have understood this. By the late 1970s, I had set off on part of a journey through languages and places whose logical cohesion lasted close to 20 years. On the surface, this journey seemed to lead away from the poetry and ways of thinking I was most intimately connected to, away from a rooted sense of place and language that, even as a first-generation American, held deep claims on me. Yet as I came to see in leading back to that part of me I can call home, this journey helped me grapple with these claims, giving me tools I could not have imagined before. Olson's work, in turn, helped me rediscover old things while finding new things to confirm my innermost sense. In a 1950 letter to Melville scholar Roland Mason, Olson wrote, "I'm struck with the feeling that the rest of the world is just now getting what the Americans have been putting up with a long time, that we are, quote, experienced, unquote, in the dread business of this reality, that Melville had the underparts of what Rimbaud didn't even know, that the Am Civil War itself was the predecessor of what this century is the international civil war of, and that the same victor now will be the gross thing which won here then, materialism." For me, this sort of understanding has led to the poetry and personal relationships I began to forge as a teenager, and to a slow but ongoing immersion in ancient America, an essential element missing in our generalized and circumscribed histories. In the interview for the Farini film Polis Is This, Amiri Baraka talks about the significance Olson's trajectory had for him. "To me, Olson's concept of the polis was just simply the idea that you had to be grounded in the concerns of the people, that the people are finally the makers of history, and that you have to be grounded in what is historical in that sense. What are the concerns of the people? Why are they these concerns? The whole question of putting the hinge back on the door, that is, trying to find out what had been hidden from us by the emergence of this new one-sided society. That was important, particularly for me being black, because I knew part of that was the connection to Africa. Where are the foundations of the world from? Charles was saying, you have to go back, you have to go back. One of the most important parts was language. You know, the expression of life is language, and you have to grasp languages. At the time, people were concerned about the same thing. What is language and life? What do they reveal in themselves?" The relegation of Olson to some netherworld of influential but unread poets has occurred through any number of restraining orders and forms of administrative detention, much of it dedicated to blocking this business of going back. Larger bureaucratic nets trap us and enable the terms of debates to remain unchallenged and limited, cutting off areas of exploration that are as vital to our sustenance as the air we breathe. Much like the intensive psychological conditioning that produced acceptable trajectories, horizons, boundaries, and limitations of discourse during the Cold War, we find ourselves now in the midst of a one-sided society that has erased its origins, development, and all consciousness of the consequences of this development. This form of society wreaks havoc on our lived experience of the past. This brings us to concerns Olson almost alone expressed when he said already in 1945, confronting the treatment of Ezra Pound, that, quote, "our own case remains unexamined," unquote. For Olson, Ezra Pound's trial was made to appear like a leftover from World War II, but may have been instead a harbinger of a new order to come. In 1945, my parents, having survived World War II as refugees from Yugoslavia, were living in Rome. In May of that year, Ezra Pound was captured by Italian partisans and handed over to the Americans for interrogation. During the same month, as detailed by Christopher Simpson in his book Blowback, Gustav Hilger, a war criminal instrumental in SS efforts to capture and exterminate Italian Jews, surrendered to U.S. forces and was, quote, "quietly shipped to Washington, D.C. for debriefing at Fort Hunt," unquote. Far from being publicly tried, as Pound would be, for the next few years, Hilger, quote, "shuttled back and forth between the United States and Germany under the sponsorship of the U.S. State Department," unquote, working under grants from the Carnegie Corporation and given posts at Harvard Center for Russian Research, Johns Hopkins University, and other academic places, serving as CIA covers under the guise of, quote, "academic freedom," unquote. While Pound was in the cage at Pisa as the demonstrable traitor, another key Nazi figure, Reinhard Gehlen, Hitler's most senior military intelligence officer on the Eastern Front, surrendered to the Americans along with his top aides. Former Nazi officers, intelligence personnel, and scientists were recruited to build up essential parts of American and NATO overt and covert operations, serving as key elements for the United States government in Europe and the Middle East during the Cold War. Bloodstone was the first such operation, and others, including Outcast, Paperclip, Pajamas, Dwindle, Apple Pie, Panhandle, Credulity, and Sunrise, followed. As macabre and absurd as some of these names are, as Simpson writes, quote, in a very real sense, the men and women who engineered Bloodstone were the same ones who designed U.S. Cold War strategy for every administration from 1945 to 1963, unquote. The consequences deepened and became part of general foreign policy, as former Nazis and collaborators on the U.S. payroll, who were also fugitives from war crimes charges, began to demand U.S. help in escaping abroad in return for their cooperation with and continuous silence about American clandestine operations. All this should sound familiar, especially in light of the subsequent American record with the Mujahideen in Pakistan and Afghanistan or Saddam Hussein in Iraq, not to mention earlier model campaigns like the Phoenix Program in Vietnam, so cogently described by journalist Douglas Valentine, and other counter-revolutionary operations in any number of places around the globe. Such deep politics, in the sense poet and historian Peter Dale Scott has defined in Deep Politics and the Death of JFK, get left by the wayside again and again, especially in trying to think through the relations of politics to history and culture. While all these Nazis were being brought into the government, Pound, a poet, was indicted in 1945, taken from Italy, and imprisoned in the District of Columbia jail in Washington. After his formal arraignment, he was transferred to a hospital in order to undergo psychiatric examination. There he was declared insane and mentally unfit for trial. After being placed in solitary confinement in the penal ward at St. Elizabeth's Federal Hospital for the Insane, now designated headquarters for Homeland Security, Pound underwent a sanity hearing on February 13, 1946. As scholar and translator Richard Seaberth writes in his superb presentation of Pound's Pisan Cantos, quote, the jury returned a verdict that the respondent was of unsound mind. In this juridical limbo, neither innocent nor guilty, and because a judge non compos mentis, no longer a legal subject with power of signature, Pound would reside at St. Elizabeth's for the next 12 years, unquote. Never a real trial, the Pound case played an important cultural, historical, and political role. It established the shadowy image of the poet through whom art's relationship to politics could be administered and cordoned off and used as a surrogate form of debate, like a condom placed over organs of policy and their effects. As mechanisms get jump-started by events, a series of stand-ins takes up the space of the actual, making it difficult, if not impossible, to talk about things outside their categorical function. The case of Olson and his concern with putting the hinge back on the door to the past follows a similar course. The poet comes to represent the inherited weight of patriarchy, or is made out to be the priest, shaman, leader of a cult, reducing the poet, the research, and the work as a whole to unintelligibility. This sort of process occurs throughout society now. 9/11 becomes Pearl Harbor, or vice versa, while talking to the terrorists becomes Chamberlain appeasing Germany. Deployment of these formulas has its own history and makes knowledge gained through experience and changes in consciousness the only place non-technical knowledge might arise and matter for the public difficult to achieve. As in various past moments of political crisis, it is worth consulting codified and contemporary official doctrine to identify the politics at work. Turning to the 9/11 Commission report, one finds parts of it as if written and vetted by staff members versed in literary and historiographical theory. Quote, in composing this narrative, we have tried to remember that we write with the benefit of hindsight. Hindsight can sometimes see the past clearly, with 20/20 vision. But the path of what happened is so brightly lit that it places everything else more deeply into shadow. Commenting on Pearl Harbor, Roberta Wohlstetter found it much easier after the event to sort the relevant from the irrelevant signals. After the event, of course, a signal is always clear. We can see what disaster it was signaling since the disaster has occurred. But before the event, it is obscure and pregnant with conflicting meanings. As time passes, more documents become available and the bare facts of what happened become still clearer. Yet the picture of how those things happened becomes harder to reimagine, as that past world, with its preoccupations and uncertainty, recedes, and the remaining memories of it become colored by what happened and what was written about it later. With that caution in mind, we asked ourselves, before we judged others, whether the insights that seem apparent now would have been meaningful at the time, given the limits of what people then could reasonably have known or done. Unquote. What is really at stake are war mechanisms, primitive triggers to reorder the past to make it conform to the logical necessity of the present. Colonization takes place across the board. There can be no liberty or liberation, no outside in the poet Jack Spicer's sense, nothing beyond an all-encompassing present that does not merely contain the past but dictates its meaning and limit. The report's conclusion states, "We believe the 9/11 attacks revealed four kinds of failures in imagination, policy, capabilities, and management." In section 11.1, titled Imagination, a new encoding is proposed. Quote, "Considering what was not done suggests possible ways to institutionalize imagination. It is therefore crucial to find a way of routinizing, even bureaucratizing, the exercise of imagination." Unquote. That's a quote from the 9/11 Commission report. So really, you know, I think it's always useful to read official reports because they frame language in certain ways and they create a horizon of expectations and of possible ways of accessing reality. And so I was really thinking about this idea of the colonization of memory, the colonization of experience, the same things that Peter is talking about in this, in childhood memory, in how a city develops, in what happens to it. And so the book really is an array of arguments around this theme. And I'm going to read one more piece, which is very different. And I'm just going to read fragments of it because I'm here and I need to do something that will respond in some way to this is a piece from my own archive that was written in the mid-70s. And it is a memory of a drive from Boston to Gloucester with my father and meeting an old friend, Emiliano Storini, who was a master printer and had a shop down on Rocky Neck, and visiting Charlie, as you'll see in this story. And it's somewhat of a imagined memory. There must be some fantasy here, but there's a very real base. And I'll begin from the point where the drive starts to get closer to Gloucester. "The boy knew they were close when the trees stopped and the sides of the road turned to jagged granite. He knew someone must have chopped all the rock up between his side of the road and the other, and he thought he saw an Indian crest the hill of rock. The Indian must have looked quickly at the highway and told his horse to turn, for no sooner did he think he saw him than the Indian disappeared. The rock stopped and the highway emptied into a small rotary. Water began and he could see the docks through telephone poles and scattered buildings. Around the rotary, the houses came close together and ran crooked up a narrow, steep street. Telephone poles stuck up at odd angles. Some leaned almost to the windows, their thick wires swaying close to thin white curtains. The street wound, curved, got closer to the water, and soon ran right alongside it. Small shacks and houses stood on stilts over the water surrounded by docks and boats. The other side of the road was filled with small shops and bigger houses. Further along, warehouses, their shingles and wood burnt brown and scorched, covered the street from both sides, leaving cars and walkers engulfed in their singed shadows. Now and then a crack between two buildings spread a shaft of light across the street. Closer to the main harbor, warehouses gave way to stilted shacks and bigger wharves. They went to the end of the road past the small boatyards to the big one on the point. A few hundred yards along the bumpy wood, the boy's father stopped in front of a small shack and honked the horn. A curtain on the single window of the place moved. The door opened and a man appeared. He bent over a bit, stuck his arm out to the boy, made a face, growled, and roughed up the boy's hair. They laughed. The man picked the boy up and spun him in the air. The boy's father greeted the other man, and they talked in the language the boy didn't get, even when he could see. The boy's father displayed the car. The man opened and closed the doors, the trunk, and hood, as if he had only a few seconds to do so before the car exploded. They grinned and shrugged at each other and talked a lot with their hands. "Todo seduto," said the man as he put his arm on the boy's shoulder. He withdrew it, leapt back a step, reached his right hand across to his left side, and from somewhere below his pocket drew his sword out of its scabbard. The boy withdrew his, and their tightened fists at the end of their outstretched right arms cut and swung through the air. They pinned each other to the spiles, each threatening the other to pierce the heart and let the loser drop to the water. The one against the spile would slip out from under or motion to the air to heed an oncoming falcon or eagle and slither away to open space. From one end of the wharf to the other, they challenged each other. They leapt from the spiles to the creaking sea-washed slats, against the side of the shack and around to the car, as the man jumped to the bumper and across the trunk, running behind his shack and up a plank that led to a boat lying on its side. The mast stuck straight out past the rotten hull as seagulls dove in and out of the pilot house. The boy ran under and back up the plank, chasing the man around the boat. They slipped and slid as the man tightrope walked the mast and jumped back to the dock before the boy finally pinned him to the door of the shack. The man grimaced in the heat, looking to the heavens. The boy kept his feet firmly planted, his fist clenched. The man cried out, letting his fist open. His arm went forward as if to stick the sword into the wood. Putting his hands together, he bowed humbly. "Ah, todo seduto, Dio mio, esecuzione, arrivederci." The boy let his fist open, went back a step, drew his empty hand through the air and bowed. They walked back to the car and the boy's father leaning against it. "Forse possiamo mangiare qualche cosa? Sì, andiamo." They walked down the wharf past the fence to the street. The boy walked between them, looking from one to the other as they talked. A waiter stood out in the sun in front of an open doorway. He adjusted the towel he had draped across his forearm, bringing it across his brow. The boy and his father led the way in as the man followed the waiter, saying, "Domani, domani," with his hand outstretched and fingers together. The waiter turned and laughed, saying, "Basta." They walked past the bar to a table in back. As they ate, the boy looked at the fish mounted on the wall behind the bar. Murky blue light came across the mirrors from under the rows of bottles. Nets hung down off a deeply strained, rich-colored molding that ran the length of the bar about a foot from the ceiling. Soft red light filtered down from the top of the molding. Different kinds of shells were caught in or tied to the nets. A man behind the bar whistled as he straightened bottles and bent every now and then to stick something in the sink or rummage through the ice. On the way back to the boatyard, the man and the boy took a meager stab at a new duel, but were slow to move. They said goodbye, and the man watched the boy and his father back out and drive away before he turned and went into his shack. They drove to the other side of the harbor, past fish-packing plants and truck terminals. On the point was a small neighborhood of old wooden houses. The women worked in the plants, filleting fish or shucking scallops, and the men fished for one thing or another. Kids sat on the hoods of dented cars. Their smaller brothers and sisters ran through the small streets, the pavement broken up in places, a burnt-out building here and there. "Same old Charlie," said the boy as he pointed at the old Chevrolet station wagon parked on the street. The wagon was covered with mud, dried dirt, and pigeon shit. Two of the tires were flat and a blanket was draped over the hood. They parked right behind it. The boy went to the car and carefully picked a corner of the blanket to peek under. The boy's father surveyed it, ran his fingers across the cracked back window, and shook his head. "Poveraccio." They walked past the car to stone steps that led to a small backyard. The steps were part of a stone wall that ran the length of five or six houses and curved around the point. The boy's father called for his friend up the back steps and began to climb them. The boy looked under the stairs. He knelt in the weeds to get a closer look at an old figurehead that leaned against the basement wall. Its wood was still solid, and a faint glimmer of the paint she was once adorned with still remained. Her face was full, with sharp eyes pulled back at the corners and thick lips. Her hair ran straight down the back of her head, coming back behind her ear to fall across her neck, barely covering a medallion. Past her, against a pile of bricks, leaned a white statue of a woman praying. She wore a long white robe. He heard steps on the landing above, then Charlie's voice. "Better come up and get your candy before I finish it." The boy turned and darted up the steps. Charlie crouched on one knee. He held both his hands out at his sides with his fists closed. The boy picked the right, empty. "Go ahead," Charlie said. The boy picked the left, nothing. "Come on, it's inside." Charlie got up and the boy craned his neck as the man got bigger and bigger until he was standing straight up. The boy followed the huge man through the doorway as he ducked to get under it. The boy's father was already inside, sitting at a table cluttered with books and papers. The place was filled with books. Maps and pictures were pinned to the walls. Charlie went to a small chest of drawers and took out a long, thin paper bag. I went all the way to the general store, you know. I don't know whether you're worth it. Charlie held the bag at a distance. The boy tugged at his pocket. He took the brown paper off and handed the boy a package of peppermint sticks. The boy wandered around the apartment and stood at a window in the bedroom and looked out to sea. A few trawlers could be seen in the distance. Packs of circling gulls followed the boats. They hung near the mast, but every now and then dove towards the water or the nets as they were being dragged in. "What's in those buildings, Charlie?" the boy called to the other room. "Not much. Can I look?" "Ask your old man." "Go ahead." The boy went down the steps through the yard to the street. He cleared some dirt off the driver's door window of the Chevy and looked inside. The dashboard was moldy and had dead bugs stuck to it. He tried the door. After a kick and a jolt, it came open. He got in the driver's seat and looked around. The boy soon tired of the car. When he couldn't get the window open to let some of the smell out, he opened the door to let himself out. He walked across the street, stepped through the rusty pipe fence, and hanging on with one arm, made his way along the base of the cement roof of one of the warehouses until he was close enough to jump. He landed well with a thud. Something crumbled and fell loose below him. Anyways, it goes on. He ends up in this, inside this warehouse where there's another kid who has a little kind of fortress in there. And he hangs out with him for a while, and the kid tells him about, you know, himself. And that gets pretty fantastic. And then he leaves there, and he stops by a bar where there's a bunch of people listening to some music and listening to races coming from Suffolk Downs. And after that, I just want to read the end of this. A guy who was a little bit three sheets to the wind had bet on a horse called Buttered Fluke. One-Eyed Jack's, well, four or five men sat in the dim amber light the bar threw on them. A few looked out the door over the water towards the sea. The song that had been on, "Give Me 40 Acres," ended in silence. The bartender sat closest to the door on a stool behind the bar. With his elbow propped on it, he surveyed the newspaper, making a pencil mark every now and then. Another song came on. The record skipped. If Jesus was alive, he'd drive a Peterbilt. Jesus, a Peterbilt. Jesus. The bartender got up and hit a switch to turn it off. He pulled the stool over and got up on it to turn the radio on. Fourth race from Suffolk. A few of the men propped up, edging their elbows closer in on the bar. 7 furlongs, fast track, high society led. At the halfway mark, One-Eyed Jacks came neck and neck. In the stretch, Buttered Fluke knows them both. Buttered Fluke, One-Eyed Jacks, high society. A man at the end of the bar stood with his feet wrapped around the foothold of his stool. He swayed a bit, then let out a cheer. "What the hell did I tell you? Buttered Fluke." He cheered again. The men next to him turned, amused. The bartender flicked the radio off, and before turning the song back on, faced the cheering man and told him to shut the hell up. "Don't get so hot about it. If you're in here at all, I sure as hell don't want to have to listen to you." The man swayed on his perch and let out another louder cheer that rose above the music. The bartender reached up for his collar and drilled him to his seat, pushing him once, then again, before letting go. The man sprawled back off his seat and landed on the floor as the others turned to look. "Damn it! God damn it! Can a guy just..." He stopped, slumped back to the floor, turned over with his nose to the ground, looked at it a minute, then pushed himself up by his arms and walked out the door. He stumbled past the boy to the middle of the street. A few kids ran by chasing each other and almost knocked him over. The man walked to the fence and sat on it. The boy started to walk away, but the man saw him and called out after him. The boy approached cautiously, standing a few feet in front of him. "Buttered Fluke," the man said and laughed. "I gave it to him this morning. Couldn't miss." The boy nodded. They looked at each other. The boy shrugged. A dog trotted up the hill, a brown mutt. His head hung low with his tongue down and wet. He stopped in front of the boy and the man. The man turned from the boy to the dog. "So, the shit finally shows up." The dog shoved his head against the inside of the man's leg. Rubbing his jowls, he put his paws up to the man's hands. The man lifted the dog up to his knees. The boy reached his hand across the dog's back, stroking his coat. The dog turned his face, cocked a bit to one side, looking at the boy with his mouth open and tongue drooping. "Is he old?" "You'd never believe me if I told you where I got him." "Maybe I would." "You wouldn't." The man hoisted the rope that hung off his belt and opened the knife tied to the end of it. He started to carve something on a post and let the knife drop. He turned to look down the rocks and pass them to the water before getting off the fence, straightening his shirt out and stuffing the knife back into his pocket. He pulled the string on it straight, then adjusted and smoothed out the lump it left in his pants. "Beat," he said. "I'm beat," and looked down the road towards the docks. The boy pet the dog, gently slapping his snout from side to side. The man walked down the hill. Halfway down, he let out a sharp whistle. The dog turned from the boy and trotted away. The boy watched them turn the corner and go out of sight. He walked on the waterside, letting his hand bounce off the upright posts of the fence. Crossing to where the Chevy was, he looked in again, kicking the flat tires and shaking his head. He went up the stone steps, through the yard, and up the steep wooden steps to the landing. Charlie and his father still sat at the table. "What'd you find?" asked Charlie as the boy came through the screen door. "Not much. They're all burnt down." "Clean up. You're a mess," said his father. Charlie got up and went to the bedroom. "Catch." The boy grabbed the towel out of the air and went to the bathroom. He closed the door and hoisted himself up on the edge of the bathtub to get to the cracked mirror the tall man used. He looked down his arms and turned to see the backs of them in his elbows, smudged with tar, grease, dirt, and charcoal. He brushed them off, then brushed off his shirt and pants before turning the water on and scrubbing his face, arms, and hands. He got back up on the tub and checked himself in the mirror. Here and there he used the towel to rub a spot clean. He hopped down and wiped the dirt his feet had left at the edge of the tub before hanging the towel on a nail that stuck out from the back of the door. When he walked back out, they were still sitting at the table. He looked at them for a minute, then went to the bedroom. Out the window, he watched the boats as they got closer before the setting sun. Peter, are we going to take some questions, or are we hot and tired?
We thought we might take a few questions before closing out.
Sorry, I went on.
No, that's wonderful. That last narrative really was extraordinary for me because it really gives you an incredibly inside view of Olson's life in the setting that Olson lived that life at Fort Square. It's very powerful, and I love it. In many ways, Amiel and I write about
the same thing,
which is why we wanted to do this together.
Shocking.
Anyone want to ask us a question or say anything? Yes, Dawn.
Just thinking about the way the men were described by Amiel there, and your account was so much sweeter, I have to say. my memory of men in the 50s, and I'm happy to include Charles Olson in that memory, they did not know how to talk to children. That was so clear, and I mean, and that's part of what our country has been through too. Maybe it's a post-World War II thing, and you know, a prior to feminism thing, but it was so obvious, and it strikes a deep chord for me. What do you think about that? I mean, Amiel, I think I know what he thinks. What do you think about it, Peter, as the successful dad commuting between Cambridge and Boston?
Well, you've also read my fiction. So that's the dark side. The fiction is the dark side. But I think, you know, there was this sense of a kind of a distance. A lot of us, and maybe Peter can speak to that to some extent, a lot of us were fathered at some sense of distance in Gloucester. Wouldn't you say, Peter?
Well, I think what Amiel is trying to describe, I think we were given this template that was normal, and everybody had to be that after the Second World War. And whether it was parenting or whatever, there were these models that we were supposed to accept. And, of course, you know, most of us had absent fathers because they didn't know what the hell to do after the war. But they were given certain models that they were supposed to imitate, I guess. And, you know, among the other things that Amiel is describing more insidiously. But
you know, I mean, one of the things I think that's a problematic to you can't separate these things out. It's all of a piece. You know, it isn't like the men were doing this.
Yeah.
It's all of a piece. You know, and there's a piece in this book that you know has raised a lot of hackles, which is about the whole piece is quotes from women poets about Olson and how influential he was to them and how important he was to them and how that has been kind of bureaucratized by critics who say, well, no, he was, you know, the macho patriarch, etc. And then yet you have all these women who are actually saying, well, I may be ambivalent about this, but he was a major influence and he made me think about the body, he made me think about my body, etc. So I don't think you can, these things are historically of a piece, you know, and they are, I mean, Olson has a text here that's extraordinary, where he says, feminine writing, so that all the world is redeemed, and history, and all the politics, and state, and subjection are for once done away with as the reason of writing. I mean, you couldn't find a more, you know, so I think it's a very complex problem. You know, I don't think it's a, you know, it's a present one, but it's a complex problem. I think.
Should ask Doc Lacey. I'm going to put you on a spot, but he's the guy that is responsible for my being a parent.
Well, he.
Do you? Know, in many ways,
care of me as a kid.
You ought to speak to that. You were very much a part of the, you know, that whole enterprise. After the war. he's a great pediatrician.
I know. I know.
Yeah, really. So any,
I know.
Any words from you, you know, while he's here?
You know, on some level, it's either easier or more difficult to connect the two of you as much alike as you are. There's a very different tone. But what I'm very intrigued about that is the same is this idea of wholeness. This idea, Amiel, where you talk about learning from Olson and others, this idea that we can actually grasp knowledge in a whole, complete way. Mm-hmm. And I think that connects also Peter to the idea of that the way that we can live our lives and sustain our communities, both environmentally and culturally, is by staying whole. That development and advertising or whatever it is, fragmentation, and that brings me to my final, I always think in threes, is something I learned from Benjamin, the way in which culture gets ripped between fashion and the artifact. You know, that the past and the future that we aspire toward, the sense of loss from the past, or lurching towards the future in some ways, if we're not located, and here comes Olson, you know, if we don't proprioccept where we are, then we will be lost. And I see that there's a similarity in both of what you're writing about, which is very inspiring to me.
Amiel says here, in A Little History, and it really resonated with me, and it's really what all my writing is about, our ability to stay in one place and allow ourselves the idleness local knowledge demands. And one of the things, I mean, I want to say two things. First of all, you should know, Amiel's parents had an enormous impact. I met them in the summer of 1956. They taught me, they spoke Italian at home. And they taught me my first Italian. And I was so influenced in the literature and in moving toward Italy and so by your parents. But it was a sense of not being taught through books, not being taught through any kind of system, being taught by being with people who were living their lives. Amiel's father, Albert, said, I'm not a painter just when I'm a painting. And Ruth, this will resonate with Ruth. I'm a painter all the time.
Yeah.
And I think that it was suddenly I realized that you don't have to be a writer. You don't have to write to be a writer. You can be a writer all the time because you integrate it into your entire way of being.
Yeah.
I'd like to say that I was a pediatrician, and when I had this man come with his family to see me, it was absolutely the supreme time of my practice. He taught me a lot. He did.
Well,
he really did.
You did too, Hamer. Believe me, you were much more than a doctor and a healer. You were a marvelous teacher, and
you were a wonderful person.
Well, thank you. Hamer taught us to. That our children were going to live their lives.
Natural children.
Yes, that's exactly. I see some other hands.
My mother, you know, mispronounced your name always as Hamer. So I always have this in my name, Hamer Lacey, always in my mind.
Yes, William.
Peter, I'm wondering if the fact that society is so transient. People are born in one place and moving to another place, and this wholeness and a sense of place that is a thread throughout your life, is it being lost? It has to be lost as people move and have different lives in different places.
I think it happens. Those of us who've been here in one place all of our lives, there are fewer and fewer of us. My own children, born in Gloucester, and traveled the world, lived everywhere. You know, they come home to Gloucester on visits, but they're like so many other people. I mean, they're all children of a larger sense of time and space.
I'd like to add that I think you discovered. I was born in New Zealand, and I'm feeling very, very sad about leaving everyone I ever knew behind. And I've lived in America for 40 years, but discovered Gloucester, and I think if you feel it in the place, I lived in Cambridge for 30 years, but came up here the last 15, and I love it. I've still got my house in Cambridge, but I won't go back there. You know, this town, I think if you feel it in this town, because this town does have what you're describing,
yes,
and you can, you know, be from somewhere else and embrace this place.
What she said. I would say the majority of the world's population is probably living where they were born.
We have. I teach a women's group at the Writers Center, and I have at least half of the women in the group are here and were born here and have lived here their whole lives except for brief stints elsewhere. And they're doing the same thing that Peter did, writing about their childhood and writing about their life and writing about what they grew up and the changes they saw here. And I think that's, I mean, it is a continuum, and as much as we're quick, because sometimes the most vocal about our best travels, there are a lot of people here who have been here the whole time and who have voices that we can pull out.
But Peter, isn't migration, I mean, the Gloucester story, that
yes,
your parents came, your father
that's
came
right.
from Greece, and so many people came from Sicily, and so
Amiel's
parents. So it's not a matter of only staying in the place where you were born, but like migration is so much a part of the city.
It is migration. And I think it's very significant. I mean, we can't look at a static Gloucester, can we?
It's much more a question, you know, it's a question of both economics and colonization. I mean, if you possess your own memory, you know, then you're okay. I mean, but if your own memory has been kind of dislodged from you, I mean, that's what Amanda was saying. You know, these are people are looking at their own memory. They're here, and, you know, that's where they are. So it's kind of, it really depends on how you know... What hold you have on it?
Just on this topic, there's an interesting anthropological truism. And David's comment aside, I mean, why you were able to deal with the Italians and whoever else you were mentioning is because the working class people sort of adapt to one another's culture. And the anthropological truism is that the people are always the same.
It's very interesting. Good. George, you might.
Yeah, well, I was just wondering, this is maybe a counter jab.
of some kind. But I was struck, one of the things I was struck by in your sense of, when you were talking about the sense of loss, is some of the things you're talking about, a great deal of it was mortality and,
right,
and memory and time. And these people are dead. The cats and dogs are gone. And I think as awful as the forces of modernity and capitalism and modern society are, even if they were transformed in a utopian way, the fact of loss, of death,
yes,
and of the decay of memory in human life, those, I think there are some things which are part of the human condition, which are different than the conspiracy of the modern. And I was wondering if you have any thoughts,
yeah,
about that.
I was always sort of operating, and we aren't here from you, I was sort of always operating on two tracks, because while I was living, while I was writing the columns and living through the experiences and the memories, there was always an underlying theme that kept emerging. As I wrote and thought about what was changing and going in Gloucester and disintegrating, my own mortality, and as I got older and older, my own mortality became very present to me. And I wrote about it many times in columns. And so as I went back last summer, I hadn't looked at these columns for over 20 years, and I went back last summer and I read all 620 of them. Judy will tell you. And not because I love what I wrote, but because I wanted to try to find some patterns and to try to put together a book that wouldn't just be pieces that were random. But George, I really love it that you asked this and brought, because that's what I discovered. I discovered that really I was mapping my own mortality against Gloucester, and Gloucester in a counter way against me. And so that the two senses of aging and disintegration and change and so forth were sort of dialoguing back and forth with each other. Now we have to hear from you.
Did Charles Olson write any unnamed poems?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, he did.
What was the question?
Did Charles Olson write any unnamed poems?
Yeah, quite a few.
What are the names?
Quite a few.
Unnamed.
quite a few poems, yes, with no title.
I would just say, in relation to your question, what I'm doing in this book also is kind of constantly testing, you know, foreign policy, domestic policy, personal experience, memory, you know, just colliding, yes, pushing them up against each other and seeing what happens, you know, because we tend not to do that. It's one thing is that, you know, so I'm just, and that's also generically what's happening. It's why you have a poem and a story and a, you know, a lecture, and I'm putting these things all in one place to force you to think about different approaches to a problem at hand.
Yes.
Could you say something about your relationship with the person at the newspaper?
Oh. Well, you know, I never ever thought that I would ever write about these things, ever.
Yeah.
I was going in a completely different direction. And what Peter Watson in getting me to write that first column about growing up in Gloucester, and then asking me to write a weekly column, what he did was, he probably knew more something about me that I didn't know about myself. And once I started writing those columns, the material poured out. I couldn't stop it. I mean, it was just absolutely amazing, to the extent that not only did I start to write the columns, but I started to write another book parallel to it called At the Cut, in which I went deeper than the columns, because in the columns I didn't write about sexual growth, yeah, and sexual development and coming of age in those kinds of ways, because I couldn't. I mean, I could write certain things, but I mean, you know, if you're writing for a family newspaper, and I could write about politics, and believe me, I wrote a lot about politics and got a lot of trouble, in a lot of trouble. But that, what Peter Watson did for me, and Peter was an extraordinary editor. I write in the book about how he edited with a light but always instructive touch, because Peter had a way of editing you and helping you write, in which he didn't impose anything on you. He drew it out of you, and he drew it out of lots of writers. Because I wasn't the only columnist. Joe Gollan had been a columnist in the 60s and 70s, and then I started writing the first weekly column, and there were a number of other people who began to write columns, and they were wonderful, wonderful columns. Regina Cole started to write a column from a completely different perspective than mine. They're extraordinary columns. And anyway, so, but this is what Peter could do. He could help us and enable us to write and to find things in ourselves that sometimes we didn't even know were there, Hamer. And he was that wonderful. Yeah. Sure. Yes.
You mentioned Wieners. Do you have any direct memories of Wieners at Denison Road in that castle with Feely? Like last year when Ed was here, he wrote a great poem about when John was out there panic reading. Do you have any direct memories as a kid? Or do you have any direct memories of Wieners out in the castle in the dance one?
I never went out there when he was living there with Panagrady. I would visit Bob Creeley in the summers that he was here. But so I don't know.
Yeah.
I think a wonderful account of that time in Gloucester and in Olson's life is in Ed Sanders' new book, which he read from here. It's a really extraordinary account.
Yeah, and my memories of John are from Boston, 69, 70s, yeah.
And from New York,
yeah.
John and I read together at BU in 1974, and it was an extraordinary experience for me. I had never read with him before, and it was really just wonderful. But so I saw it.
Did you ever spend time with John and Olson together?
No.
I have such a mix of feelings, right? You know, I think that if people like the two of you who are examples of the incredible individuals who are here, and I don't know, I grew up in Newton, and it wasn't at all exciting. You know, I mean, I have family that are important to me, but there was never the grittiness and the mix of cultures, and there's something here, you know, that allows all of us to just be who we are. And I've never experienced, you know, like Allison said, I've never experienced anything like this. And I never grew up with what you have in terms of memory. And and my memory as an artist comes from a whole other place in a way. But I just
part of my writing is really also, you know, you have to come to value it. It's not just given that those memories are valuable, and you know, and to figure out what they actually mean, both personally and then historically, is a long journey. You know,
there are things that happen to you in very significant ways. Olson changed my life forever. I would not be writing what I'm writing today. I wouldn't be the person I am today. I wouldn't. He had this ability to give this to people, and many, many, many of us who were close to Olson received this gift. He helped you be yourself. How many writers have said Charles gave me permission to be myself? And I had an experience with Olson shortly before he died. Vincent and I and Jonathan Bayliss were at his house, and he turned to me. He gave each one of us an assignment, almost as though he had some foreknowledge that he wouldn't be around long. And he turned to me and he said, Anastas, your assignment will be to write the secret history of Gloucester. And I never understood it, really. Well, what's the secret history? What, you know, I'm living in Gloucester. Ever since then, and I don't in any way claim to be anywhere close to writing the secret history of Gloucester, but that he knew something enough about me, and he knew enough about my relationship and living in the city to be able to say that. And I took it seriously, like you do from a teacher that you really trust. It's being in Gloucester. There's an atmosphere that has always been in Gloucester, and we can't allow it to be taken away from us and lost. We can't allow it to be eroded. We can't allow it to be developed over and urban renewalized. You know, we can't because if we lose it, we won't be ourselves anymore. And what you're talking about is that permission, that atmosphere, that ability of all of us to have these relationships, to care, and to come together from all these different backgrounds, at any rate. So thank you for that.
Higher gossip.
Well, yes, higher gossip. I mean, we always talk about that.
You know, also, this thing about memories and relationship of, you know, as one... Mm-hmm. obviously gets older, it really is a human trait. And I surprised myself when I wrote the afterword for Peter's book. A quote that I love dearly by the Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish immediately came to mind. And it's a quote when he comes to Beirut as a refugee, as a six-year-old refugee from Palestine. And he talks about riding the streetcar and the vision that he has of riding the streetcar and how magical it was. Talks about how big the banana leaves were, take me to the streetcar, and how grand the sea was. And then at the end of the passage, he says, when I came back to Beirut 10 years ago, the first thing I did was stop a taxi and say to the driver, take me to Damour, which is where he first came. I had come from Cairo and was searching for the small footsteps of a boy who had taken steps larger than himself, not in keeping with his age and greater than his stride. What was I searching for? The footsteps or the boy, or for the folks who had crossed a rocky wilderness only to reach that which they didn't find, just as Kavafi never found his Ithaca. The sea was in place, pushing against the moor to make it bigger, and I had grown up. I had become a poet searching for the boy that used to be in him, whom he had left behind someplace and forgotten. The poet had grown older and didn't permit the forgotten boy to grow up.
Wow.
That's extraordinary, because you know, that's just extraordinary, because you have to the memory also has to grow. You can't stunt the memory, you know. And
how about when I don't even know how to word this, when the memory, what's been taken, the loss of that makes you angry.
Mm-hmm.
For me, not a little boy but a little girl growing up on the Annisquam River, and that being at Wingashee Beach, being the only boat over there all day, thousands of, several horseshoe crabs,
mm-hmm.
which you never see anymore,
mm-hmm.
right? Replaced by anchor lines and coolers and grills and beer cans, and the place is still there,
but
it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
It's been taken. I mean, you can go on a -7-degree day in the middle of winter.
Right.
that's really beautiful.
It's still there, but taken.
That's beautiful. I'd like to end just with a very brief selection from Amiel's book, because I think from the Warring Fashion, because we're all here. The Writers' Center is interested in opening people up to writing. We talk about writing as process. We talk about writing as a way of living and a way of learning. Amiel writes here, being a writer entails responsibility, first to yourself and the language you are using, But then beyond that, to disrupt accepted patterns of seeing things, to get people to pay attention to things in the world that matter. It means taking risks outside the circumscribed risk-taking. And I think that, in many ways, is what we're all trying to do, and whether we're painting, whether we're writing, no matter what we're doing. And I think this, we have to disrupt these old patterns, don't we? We have to take risks. I think, you know, you've certainly done it. This is an extraordinary book, and you've taken enormous risks. At any rate, well, thank you all for coming. We just wanted to say something.
Signing books.
I'm really sorry.
Let's go over here. There's a book signing area. You got a pen?
Thank you.